You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Go Wild. Go Wild is the fastest growing social media app for outdoor enthusiasts. If you love to hunt, if you love to fish, if you love to hike, if you love to camp, if you like to be outdoors, then you need to download the Go Wild app. It's a perfect place for you to join a community of people, like-minded people who enjoy the same things that you do. You won't be persecuted for posting a trophy pic. You won't be persecuted for, you know, posting meat or whatever like they do on, you'll get some haters every once in a while on Instagram and Facebook. But I think it's a really good place for you to not only share what you do, but join a community, and that allows you to meet other people. And who knows what happens when you meet other people. A specific example of is I posted a comment or something about shed hunting, and I met a guy who shed hunts near me, and I think we're going to team up and go on a shed hunt together this fall. This spring. So if you haven't had the opportunity, go to the Google Play Store, download the Go Wild app, and if you want some more information, you can also go to their website, timetogowild.com. Get outside. It's time to go wild.
Welcome to the For Love of the Land podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith
and Matt Dye.
Each week, we're interviewing guests from across America. They all have one thing in common. They all are tied to the land. So if you're like us and you love all things land, welcome home.
Hey guys, Adam here.
Matt here too.
And we've got your For Love of the Land podcast. We're going to be another very relatable topic.
Oh yeah.
Something for everybody to kind of
latch onto
and then hear some brainstorm. You're going to have a brainstorming session with some of the ideas that he's going to throw out there and ways of purchasing or working with the government to move forth with land purchasing and land improvements. Lots of announcements though before we jump into that podcast.
Yeah, for sure.
Three of them about the QDMA.
Yes.
So we've got QDMA Whitetail Weekend, April 12th and 13th at headquarters.
Yeah.
Right there in
Georgia.
I was Gallagher. trying to think of the town, Peach. Anyway. Bogart, Georgia. Yep. That's correct. QDMA headquarters, Whitetail Weekend, lots of in the field stuff. We may or may not be there. We're trying to get some scheduling done to where we could be there. But even if we're not, it's a great opportunity to head to QDMA National Headquarters and get your noggin full of all kinds of information about whitetail and land management. Also, we have early bird registration for Deer Steward 2 course in Ohio, Gallipolis, Ohio, on a property that we are working with and managing there in
We will certainly
Southeast
be there.
Ohio, and we will be there for
hosting
that.
Hosting the event. That I'm looking forward to.
That's Did I say September 13th through the 16th? I don't think I said
not
it.
Not yet. There you go. Those are the dates.
That is Deer Steward 2 course. So if you haven't gone through Deer Steward 1 yet, make sure you do that before. And go ahead and sign up for that and join us over there. Lots and lots of really cool habitat information and techniques used over there to help you on your property.
Absolutely.
The third thing for QDMA is March 23rd. Matt will be in Dayton, Ohio for a workshop there with, what's the name of the branch?
Deer Management Workshop. It is with, can't remember off the top of my head, honestly.
Oh, it doesn't say what branch?
Local Twin Creek QDMA branch. Twin Creek QDMA branch out of Dayton, Ohio. Be there speaking a couple topics. That is Saturday, March 23rd at, what is that? The Miami Valley Center Career Technical Center.
As much time as we spend in Ohio, we might as well get a second home over there. Because it is ridiculous how much we go to Ohio.
I know. This time, at least it's a flight, not a drive. That 10-hour drive's getting...
Yeah.
Well, I know it by heart now. I mean, I don't... No GPS, just go.
Yeah,
go to the metal.
When we had, it is just,
and we're going to be back again. I know.
In May.
In May, and possibly.
In March, possibly.
Another time in March, possibly. So.
And then we'll be back in September.
Yep. Yeah.
My goodness. Yeah.
I'm going to get an air a little. What's that? Airbnb.
Yeah.
Just rent it out.
Yeah. Buy a house and make it an Airbnb. And then whenever we go in there, we don't have to pay.
Yeah, there we go.
And then also, March 1st and 2nd. So that's next weekend. We will be at the, or this coming weekend.
Yep.
Farm and Gin. I think it's the Mid-South Farm and Gin Show in Memphis, Tennessee.
With Stratton Seed. They'll be there.
Yes, we'll be there at the Stratton Seed booth. Not your hunting expo. This is one.
This is cool.
Let me be honest with you. I enjoy these shows more than the hunting shows a lot of times. So this is going to be a lot of equipment, a lot of implements, a lot of farming stuff, agriculture stuff. So we're going to be there. It's a big show. Come and see us if you're anywhere near Memphis, Tennessee. This next weekend, the 1st and 2nd of March. Also, one last announcement. Quail Forever, Missouri State Banquet. Quail and Pheasants Forever, Missouri State Banquet, March 16th. We will be there presenting.
Yep.
What's the actual title of our presentation? Or what did they tell us?
Basically, we're talking about new ways of getting folks outdoors. In essence, is the topic. I don't think there's a title set yet, but basically the importance of education on habitat and land management and sharing those different educational topics.
Here it is. Take it outside. That's the title.
Take it outside?
That's it. Like when you're going to get in a fight or whatever, let's take it outside.
Take it outside, guys.
Yeah.
Just get outside.
Take it outside. So that's really what our it's going to be new ways to get people outside.
New ways of intriguing and letting the outdoors and nature just speak to people. So that'll be fun. That'll be cool. That's March 16th, right?
Finally, something Columbia. To talk about that's not just deer hunting. Yeah. Right?
Columbia, Missouri. So be sure to join us there if you're in Missouri. There's a lot of other great speakers, too, that are truthfully there. There's lots of breakout sessions.
Frank Longcarriage
from
MDC with the quail. The second half of the there's the dynamic duo.
Right.
Kyle and Frank of the quail study that we had Kyle on the podcast a couple weeks ago.
Yep.
Frank is the other guy involved in that research. He will be there presenting on their study. And there's all kinds of awesome stuff.
Maybe we can get Frank on and do a podcast when Kyle's not there and get a bunch of dirt on Kyle.
That's it.
From Frank.
Or get the actual other part of the research. Yeah.
All that other stuff you heard was just fluff.
Yeah. No, I think I forget all the stuff they have going on, but a lot of really cool breakout sessions and opportunities to learn about quail habitat management or all things quail.
Early successional habitat, everything that you're looking to know more about, pollinators, CRP programs, a lot of great minds are going to be there at the Quail Forever, Pheasants Forever meeting March 16th. It'll be fun for us.
Do I dare say a lot of true habitat management techniques going to be discussed there.
For sure. Rather prescribed than fire,
yes.
Dormant season disking, a lot of cool things.
That's right. So hopefully you guys will meet us at any of all of these places that we just rattled off. You may have to rewind and go through it because there's a ton of places we're going to be over the next few months. So
that's right.
Anyway, Matt.
Yes. So
brief introduction here.
This is an interview this week with Glenn Dye. He is a cousin of mine. I grew up with just a few miles down the road. His dad and my dad are first cousins, and they grew up across the street from each other, both farming backgrounds, of course, and both crop and hay and cattle. Anyhow, Glenn has really adopted the crop side of things and is a full-time farmer, supporting his family and farming about 1,500 acres in North and Central Virginia. So he is very involved with NRCS practices, with cover cropping, no-till drilling, and just a big proponent, advocate, and knowledge base of agronomy. So soil health, soil fertility, talks about his kind of his walk from college up through starting his own business and acquiring land. So extremely cool. We haven't just talked with a crop farmer in the past, so this one obviously touched close to home. He's got a lot of great insight and a lot of cool things that new farming techniques are bringing on. The technology behind things right now is just almost overwhelming. And it's neat to see how things have changed so drastically in such a short amount of time. But it's truthfully making that technology, if used right and appropriately, is making things environmentally more sound. And he'll get into that from a fertilizer, liming, soil amending side of things. So be sure to listen. Enjoy it. I think you guys will be able to learn and honestly make a lot of parallels between what he's doing on a daily basis to making overall land that much healthier and working it together as a system. All righty. I think we're ready to rock and roll. Glenn, are you there?
I'm here.
All right. So I know you're ready to talk farming for a good half hour, 45 minutes. Ready?
There you go.
So we did a little intro kind of discussing a little bit of our history. Obviously, we're cousins. Basically, dads are first cousins, correct?
Correct.
I don't even know, honestly, where that puts us. It doesn't matter. Cousin is a cousin.
I was going to say.
I don't get all that whole relation crap. It is what it is. But we have grown up, you know, childhood-wise, living not too far from one another. So you're quite a bit older than me. However, through farming this and that and just being so close, we've kind of had halfway grown up together.
Right.
But obviously career-wise, gone different paths. And I've shared my story on the podcast quite a bit. But basically, you know, having kind of the background of you know, my granddad working cattle and, you know, doing the whole hay thing, that whole, okay, if you will, working the land was intriguing to me, but I had a heck of a passion for wildlife. And so I kind of put the two and two together and said, okay, well, what is there that I can do wildlife-wise but still kind of work the land? And then out comes, you know, land and legacy. But for you, you kind of filled in shoes, I guess, more routinely in what your grandfather did and your dad. So talk to us a little bit about kind of how you got started there from your farming background.
Yeah, it was, like you said, both of us are very much influenced by our grandfathers. And,
absolutely.
When granddaddy passed in 99, I was 13 at the time, and I don't know, something had clicked with me, and I realized and recognized that I needed to pitch in and pull my weight, for lack of better terms, even though, I mean, being that young, I don't know, I felt a passion to pick up the void that was left.
Mm-hmm.
And It that's where it started. Growing up before that, I mean, dad and granddaddy both were great about letting me do what I wanted to do. I mean, I thought I was just going to play professional baseball, and that's all it was to it. Quickly realized that, I mean, we have good genes, don't get me wrong, but they just weren't quite good enough.
That's right. And,
so when granddaddy passed, it kind of made me see that I needed to help out and wanted to help out, and it just kind of evolved from there. Dad let me do as much or as little as I wanted to do. Never pushed me. And I've thanked him many times in adulthood now.
Mm-hmm.
And for not pushing me to be who he wanted me to be, to let me figure it out.
That's right. In that learning process, as you know, as you got started after 13, was there like that aha moment of, okay, I know there was, you know, a void, you know, you need to kind of fill in, do this and that, but was there like that aha moment that, whether it's education or just an experience while in the field, that you're like, man, this is what I want to do. This is going to be like lifetime. Did you have that?
Yeah. And, I mean, I enjoyed every aspect of it. I mean, we all enjoy working with our fathers. Mm-hmm. That was the motivation for me. Uniquely, we get along, and I mean, we spat every now and then, but I mean, we get along.
Just like any other relationship.
Right. And I mean, we complement each other really well, and mm-hmm. it really works. I don't know. I think about one memory I have. It was senior year of high school, I won the district golf tournament that day.
Yep.
And since we were out of school for the tournament that day, after the tournament, I went and shelled corn for Dad.
Right.
And I joked. I was like, you know, up until that point, that was one of the greatest days of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Winning a golf tournament, running a combine at night, man, it didn't get any better than that.
What a combination.
And that was the first time that he'd really turned me loose and let me run it on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I'd always rode with Granddaddy in the combine. And granted, I'd slept quite a bit in the combine more than paid
naps.
Attention.
Right.
But I enjoyed the combine and aspect of it. I enjoyed the grain side of it. And that was kind of, that was a hurdle, you know, growing up where we grew up, was development mm-hmm. taking over like it had. The grain side of thing had really kind of diminished by the time I was old enough to be able to do anything. Dad had, you know, developed into a horse hay and mm-hmm. straw operation, not so much grain. So that I thought that was what I wanted to do, and wanted to do the grain, but it was just harder and harder to do at home.
Right. So you went soon after the senior year in college, you ended up going to school, senior year in high school, you ended up going to college. You've got a degree in agronomy, is that right? Soil science?
Right. And okay. They put the complicated term of crop and soil environmental science.
I see.
And it used to be agronomy. So mm-hmm. it was an agronomy emphasis, because they had a couple different emphases in the department. But yeah, mm-hmm. I started down in ag business at Penn State.
Right.
Went there for 2 years and transferred to tech.
Yep.
To finish out the last two, and change majors when I did.
My gotcha. From an education standpoint, and this is always a fun question. We get it a lot from people who are interested kind of in our experiences and kind of, the education that we have versus, you know, just experience in the field. But, and I'm a huge believer in education. I think you get it from a lot of different resources and a lot of different, people and just fields itself. But as a full-time crop farmer now, what do you think has been education-wise the most influential part of your learning? Was it college or just years in the field, growing season after growing season, watching and learning? Or has it been outside research that you've just, you know, kind of clung to and, you know, been doing, you know, from probably after your kids go to sleep? And then, you know, what's been the most impact there from a learning side?
I mean, we learn all sorts of things, and we learn the most from mistakes, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd say in college, I mean, everybody asks, you know, was it worth it, this and that?
Sure.
And my short answer is yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I know not everybody can say that.
Right.
Depends
on your college experience.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. And, I mean, going to both schools, that was a big benefit for me, networking-wise. I mean,
sure.
I've met so many people in business. I mean, even after the fact, doing business with friends of friends, or just the connections there.
It's unreal.
I mean, it's all about – it's not what you know, it's who you know.
It's the truth.
And that's really played dividends. But, no, I had my senior year at Tech, I had a soil fertility professor
mm-hmm.
who was one of the – I say the best in the country,
mm.
Just very well known worldwide, really. And he was extremely difficult,
right.
And it was the toughest C+ I ever got in my life.
You worked for that,
but
yeah,
but I learned, and that
sure.
and that was what he was after.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want you to go out of, you know, leave that class with a grade. He wanted you to leave with the knowledge of what was being taught.
Sure.
And now in profession, I value that deeply. I mean, it's, I know how things work because of that class,
mm-hmm.
as far as fertility and chemistry and
sure.
It wasn't a, well, let's just move on kind of thing. He didn't go on until you knew what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
I, I hate to admit it, but I failed the first exam with flying colors. He called me into his office, mm-hmm. and the first and only professor that ever did that in my college career,
right.
called me into his office. And he had done a bunch of research with Johnny Davis and Tommy Hicks and him down at Port Royal. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
we had a connection there. We had chatted about that in class. And he was, I remember it like it was yesterday, Matt. He said, "Glenn, I like you, but I will fail you." And I mean, he was just dead serious.
Yeah,
and I knew it too. I mean, Tommy and him had joked that after the first exam that he brings tissues into the class for all the kids that are crying about the grades and this and that. And I told him, I said, "Man, he didn't give me any tissues, but I can tell you, I believe that now."
Yeah, no kidding.
But he did. He, it really hit with me. And I got my act together and buckled down and battled back,
mm-hmm.
and learned the material. And it's been so helpful in what I do now.
Wow,
I didn't know that it would be,
mm-hmm.
but it has been.
Yeah, I mean, obviously this is nothing new to you, but like soil is a building block. And just like in that class, you have to, you have to get the basics to understand the more complicated and the more in-depth you go.
Right.
You can't just skip ahead like, "Oh, I get that." Like, it just builds and builds and builds on the very principles of things. And so there's a couple of classes and subjects in my school that was very similar to that. It's like, wow, it just kind of sets you back on your heels a little bit. Because I know you're a good student. I was a good student. And there's a couple of those classes that you're like, I really need to buckle down. Like, I need to really grasp this from the very beginning and then go forward, because wow, if I don't, I'm going to get behind. And and now I look back, I'm like, okay, even things that have, I feel like shouldn't be related to maybe that subject or that field, I can tie back like, oh, there's where that principle just kind of pops back up. And you're like, I understand that. I can grasp this a little bit better and how things are just so interconnected.
Well, and that's, I joke, that was a money-making course,
mm-hmm.
for me.
Right.
I mean, now in what I do, I didn't know I was going to be doing what I'm doing.
Sure.
But now that I am, I mean, I know the basics that, soil fertility is based upon, and I can figure out what I need. I don't have to take what some, I hate to say it, but what some, fertilizer salesman is telling me what
sure.
I need. I can either confirm or disprove, or I mean, there's all sorts of miraculous juice that you can pour in with
right.
this and that, and it's going to give you this yield bump. And and I tell people, I'm like, let's stick to the basics and get that correct first, and
there you go,
then we'll worry about, so it definitely taught me to keep my eyes open and work with what's known first. But
that's right.
And he was such a mentor to me. I mean, we still keep in touch. I mean, we just sent him a birth announcement when Grace was born. And,
oh, nice. Yeah.
No, I feel for the students coming through now, because he is retired,
mm-hmm.
that they're not getting
that value.
That value that I got out of it.
Sure. Well, it's funny you said, about that, like that magic juice. I think with whatever industry you're in, there's always like that ability to try and market products that are like, oh, jump, skip this step or get ahead, do this, apply this and that. Like, we see that in our industry, and it's like the marketing behind it is like, oh, it makes it sound so good and save you money and save you time. But truthfully, and I think that's where, Land of Legacy comes in, is like, okay, here are the principles, here are the building blocks. Let's get this right first, and then you'll be able to see what the growth and the development and the benefits and the productivity out of your habitat. And no different from what you're doing on a crop side, on the soil fertility side, just back to the basics, learning, and I don't want to say science, but it is science. I mean, it doesn't have to be complicated science though either. It's just foundational principles. And from there, you just take it and go. So I guess my next question is, okay, you went to school, you did that, but you didn't go right into just full-time farming. You had a couple other jobs and stuff. What that I'm sure allowed you to get to the point where you're like, okay, now I'm comfortable stepping out and doing farming full-time. What was that process like? And what was that kind of breaking point that said, okay, I'm going all in, I'm doing it, I'm going to make a career out of this?
It was tough. I worked at a John Deere dealership right out of school for 4 years, and mm-hmm. a lot of that was on the recommendation of another farmer, actually. Mm-hmm. senior year of college, I interviewed him for a senior seminar class.
Okay.
And I asked, you know, I guess one of the questions was, do you have any advice for this and that? And he said, go work for somebody else. He said, you know, go work under somebody else other than a family member.
Right.
He said, you can always come back to the farm. It'll always be there.
Sure.
And I was, you know, fortunate that Dad was doing that.
Mm-hmm.
He said, but go get the experience under somebody else. See how they run things. See, you right. know, see it through their eyes. And that was great advice. I did.
Mm-hmm.
And went and worked for somebody else. Was completely happy working.
Yeah.
Under the boss that I had. He was a great boss. And we do business now.
Mm-hmm.
But it was tough being where I was. And, you know, you come home at night, and especially when I was living at home, you talk to Dad about his day and what all he's been doing and seeing how hard he was running. And
right.
It was just another one of those moments where I was like, look, you know, I went part-time first,
mm-hmm.
To help Dad. And then I'd work at the dealership like 3 days a week, and quickly found out it wasn't enough money there with Dad
yeah.
to do that. So I went back full-time at the dealership. But what really made me try to do it was, the first landlord that I rented land from, I started with 41 acres over there at Mr. Crocker's, you know, mm-hmm. where we're at,
yep. and
it picked up a little bit as the couple of years went on, and as his battle with Alzheimer's got worse, he decided to rent me the whole farm.
Yep.
And it wasn't a big place by any means. I mean, it's one of my biggest pieces right now. But it was 200 and some acres, and Dad had let me farm a few fields of his. So I was, I don't know if I was 400 acres yet, mm-hmm. but I decided that just seeing how things were going with trying to do that on the side and work at the dealership, it just wasn't, I needed to dedicate myself to one or the other.
Sure.
And so I decided it was hard. I was emotional when I told my boss what I was doing. And
mm-hmm.
of course, I mean, he was all for it. He's like, look, you don't do it, you'll never know.
That's right.
And so that was kind of, we jumped in feet first, and I hit it, I'd say probably the most perfect time in row crop agriculure. We had come off a drought, and prices were good, and I lucked out and had some really good yields out the gates, and
mm-hmm.
probably had the best luck that I'll have in my farming career. I hope I see it again, but
sure.
that definitely helped me get started.
Right.
So,
and then that was just a sheer, you know, yield standpoint and you know, kind of the way the market was at the time, correct?
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to do a good job agronomically and had
uh-huh.
had good yields, and especially 2012, I remember that was when the Midwest had a terrible drought.
Yeah.
And it was the worst yields I had, but they were still good enough with the prices that we were getting to
uh-huh.
to still do all right.
Sure. So, moving then into full-time farming, now what's operation size, you know, I guess 6-7 years later after moving full-time, what how much are you farming? I know you're down, you got farms as far as 3 hours apart from each other. We'll kind of get into that story in a little bit, but what size are you at now?
A little over 1500.
Okay.
I'd say right around 1500.
Gotcha. So to be able to make, you know, that jump and increase, you know, the number of acres that you're doing, and I know that you're enrolled and doing some work with the NRCS and nutrient management plans. Can you kind of explain your connection there and the benefit of being enrolled and understanding those programs that it's afforded you?
Yeah, they've played a big part in the operation, especially in the cost share side of things, of, mm-hmm. of helping implement some practices. But yeah, I've with the NRCS, I've been a big participant in their EQIP program.
Okay.
With multiple practices, whether it be a cover crop program, a diversified cover crop program, mm-hmm. a no tillage program, especially at home in the Chesapeake Bay. That's right. That's a big one. They have a 590, I call it 590. It's a nutrient management program mm-hmm. where it's, they've got three levels, A, B, and C, C being the highest level of management. And I've participated in level C. That's when we break it down into the technological side of things with, you know, yield maps, overlaying those with soil type, soil sampling based on zones, and then mm-hmm. fertilizing the fields, variable rate, fertilizer lime.
So basic,
across the field.
Basically, you're saying instead of going into a field, taking random samples of the entire field and saying, okay, here's your field average, and applying based on that, the whole field on that field average, you're talking going in and fertilizing different zones differently on what those zones are saying. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
So from an application standpoint.
No longer are we doing a blanket, right?
Right. From an application standpoint, how does that change things?
Well, it puts the right amount of nutrients where they should be.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, everybody asks me that because I've been a big proponent for that, especially, you know, I sell Ag Leader Technology,
yep.
Precision products. Everybody asks, what do you save? I said, well, I can't tell you that I'm saving. I said, but I can tell you I'm putting the right amount right where it's supposed to be.
Sure. That makes sense.
No more, no less. I mean,
sure.
It's so, I love it when I'm going across the field and I see the belt cut off because I'm not putting anything out.
Yeah.
That means I've got that zone fertilized to its maximum potential. It doesn't need anything else.
Mm-hmm. And so this is all through GPS and coordinating, you know, inputs
right.
and software into the GPS. And so as you're driving a fertilizer buggy around, you know, it's reading that software and what the inputs in that portion or zone should be and applying as necessary, correct?
Right.
Right, right, right. So
yeah.
I mean, it makes perfect sense. Okay, why apply where it doesn't need it and do the blanket treatment or application across the whole field? Just do it where it's necessary. And that's that. Honestly, it's not any more scientific, but it's just a practical sense. It's like, why put that time and resource into the acres or portions of the field, the zones that don't need it?
Exactly. And I mean, fertilizer prices today, it's proper agronomic practice and environmental practice, but the mm-hmm. economical side of it too is, you know, we're putting our money where it's supposed to be.
Sure.
And not wasting. That's mm-hmm. that's the biggest key to my operation and being able to be successful so far, is just to be as efficient as possible.
Efficient with time and the resources.
Right.
Sure. And so any other type of practices that you've enrolled some of these acres in with the NRCS that you're doing annually?
Those are the big ones. Mm-hmm. Of course, we've got the grass waterway,
yep.
critical area management, stuff like that. I've tinkered with the idea of some pollinator stuff.
Yeah.
Man,
we're all about that. If you need some help,
I know. So it's the possibilities out there are endless, really.
Man,
I mean,
they are.
A bunch of different things. It helps to have somebody that knows what how to put it all together, I guess, is
sure.
a big thing.
Sure.
And
navigate that. I guess from a – and, you know, every agent is different, you know, who they work with in their given area. But how has that process been of going, okay, to the NRCS, a local, you know, agent, and been, okay, here's what I want to do. Here's what I got. Obviously, it's been helpful to you, but what's that process been like from, you know, talking with them and then getting actually plans and stuff done?
I've had a very positive experience.
Good.
I've heard some horror stories and, mm-hmm. and have some buddies that have other opinions of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been very fortunate. The district that I've worked with has had great technical
service
responsibility
providers.
For it, and supervision has been great. I mean, really, they've been open arms. They want people to come to them and want to try these things. They want to make it work for you.
Absolutely.
And it's, you know, some things don't work. It's mm-hmm. I mean, not everything fits everybody's operation.
That's right.
But no, I've had very good luck. Even now at the new farm this year,
mm-hmm.
Signed up for some programs down there to start implementing, and it was, you know, some of it's new to them, and I think that's kind of intimidating, I'd say.
Right.
Especially, I mean, I threw a pretty big plan on them, and they kind of stepped back, like, "Whoa, hold on now." And,
what did that plan include then?
Well, it was, I mean, the new farm.
Oh, yeah.
We haven't really talked about that, but the new farm is in an area that's not, I'd say, a high management
mm-hmm.
part of the state. It is out of the Chesapeake Bay, so that's
right.
one part.
That's different.
That kind of, you know, it doesn't. I guess it doesn't. I don't know what the word I'm looking for. People aren't really.
They're not as pushed
encouraged.
To do those programs. I
right.
Think.
I shouldn't say encouraged. I mean, everybody's right. encouraged, but it's not as imperative.
Mm-hmm.
We're
mm-hmm.
at home in the bay. I mean, that's all we hear. Bay,
that's
the
right.
bay, the bay, the bay.
Right.
So these practices were kind of new to them. And the fact that I was going to be doing so many.
Right.
Which it was what I'm already doing at home.
Mm-hmm.
Just this farm down here hadn't seen that level of management.
Sure.
And so it took a few meetings and explanations of what I'm doing, how I'm doing it, and it's great now. I mean, we've got a great relationship. They, you know, encouraged to see how things are going to go. I mean, it was a little bit longer of a process, more
right.
educational, so
mm-hmm.
to speak, more meetings to show them. How this was all going to work.
Sure.
But they weren't against it from any standpoint at all. They just
right.
they needed to look into it more on their own because they hadn't had to before.
Sure. It was new to them, and it was just working
right.
through that new relationship.
Right.
So I guess from a cost share standpoint, what is some of that? You don't have to throw out figures or anything, but, you know, what does that look like from your side? Or, you know, when you look at a nutrient management plan and following through with that, what does that in return come back to you?
So say that again.
So from a, you know, a cost share standpoint, what does that look like, the benefit for you? Like how are they cost sharing that program for a farmer?
Well, for the nutrient management side of things, it's basically passed through me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm certified to write my own, but now the
yep.
state has the state has kind of not cracked down on it, but they don't want the farmer writing his own plan, which I see that.
Sure. Yep.
I get that. I mean, I didn't get it for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
I got it out of college because I got a scholarship to take the test. But
right.
So basically the cost share funds is paying for my nutrient management plan being written.
Right.
Because I'm having a third party do that now.
Mm-hmm.
Buddy of mine I went to college with, he's doing my nutrient management plan and doing all my precision sampling and,
okay.
and zone creations and prescriptions. And this year will be variable rate seeding. So he's going to be writing those as well.
Okay. Cool.
It's like
that
we talked
variable
earlier.
Rate seeding from a crop standpoint or a cover cropping or both?
No, it'll be mainly from a crop standpoint,
okay.
corn and more corn than anything.
Mm-hmm.
Corn, we see a bigger return than anything else right now.
Gotcha.
But that'll be the same idea. We'll have
right.
zones,
mm-hmm.
And the planter will change the population rate.
Yep.
Based on those zones and the prescription that's written. So it's a lot of it is the cost share. Like I said, that goes, you know, to them. The same thing with like that 590 program that helps offset the cost of him sampling and write my prescriptions.
Mm-hmm.
And then the cover crop cost share, it helped this year. I flew all of my cover crop on.
Right. right.
hard as that is to believe, and still for me to believe it.
And from an airplane or a helicopter standpoint?
Airplane.
Okay.
Yeah, I've got a guy with a fixed wing that, mm-hmm. that I've worked with for years. I've always done it in my corn,
yep.
Fly it in the standing corn. Timing is the biggest thing, and that's where we are climate-wise. It's so hard for us to get our covers established in a timely manner to
sure.
to get a beneficial growth before winter kill
yeah.
on some species, or you know, before winter sets into dormancy for the others.
Mm-hmm.
And the plane has really made that possible. It's no replacement for a drill. I won't say that at all.
Sure.
Seed to soil contact is important,
mm-hmm.
whatever you're planting. But with some of these covers like rye or wheat, you know, some of them are, we joke, you can throw it on asphalt and it's going to come up somehow.
That's right. With a little bit of moisture, sometimes it'll germinate.
Right. You yeah. put some moisture on it, it'll come up. So the weather we had this year, I mean, typically I fly it on the corn, then I'll cut the beans and drill behind them.
Mm-hmm.
But being separated to two farms this year, there was no way I was going to be able to do that.
Yeah.
So I flew the corn. I even flew over the beans.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a whole nother management standpoint there on beans. Just with the foliage is so much different than the corn.
Sure.
Row spacing and everything else.
Right.
But rode, saw it this weekend for the first time in a couple months. And I'm pleased with it. We nailed the timing this year, which I hadn't been able to do.
Well, and we've talked about that, you know, the different ways of cover cropping, and it basically just boils down to, okay, from an aerial standpoint, when you actually get the crop out is completely variable every single year, yet
right.
the timing, the window of planting doesn't typically change very much, you know, each year. So, okay, then the method has to change of the what, you know. You can't always drill because you don't ever know when harvest is, but you still have to plant the right time. And so that's where your aerial seeding has really come into play and helped you to truly establish a very sound producing cover crop that actually accomplishes the goal of having the cover crop. Instead of just putting seed in the ground way late and actually not developing a root system and growing and basically cycling those nutrients. But now with aerial, you get it in timely, and you harvest when you can harvest.
Right. And that's the other thing. I mean, for the cost share to, you know, to be approved, you mm-hmm. have to have a certain level of growth by a certain date.
Right.
And a lot of times, you know, if you're waiting to drill, you're not going to get there. So then, I mean, I've had that happen where their cost share doesn't happen. So you footed the whole bill for the cover crop. Which,
sure.
I mean, we're seeing agronomic benefits from it is
mm-hmm.
while we're doing it. We're not farming for a cost share program, but it
right.
certainly helps
oh,
to
sure.
offset things.
No doubt, no doubt. So talk about those benefits from a farming standpoint, soil fertility. You know, we talk about it within, you know, just a food plot application, but you're on a much larger scale and obviously much more precision when it comes to the agricultural standpoint than a stinking food plot where you're just trying to get tonnage. You're just trying to grow as much as you can, but you're talking a different angle. So what are those benefits from a cover crop standpoint that you're seeing in your field?
Multiple things. I guess I'll start from start to finish. It's the one big thing, and it depends on the species too.
Oh, absolutely.
A lot of mine is rye,
mm-hmm.
Just because it's easier to get established.
Right.
So you're maintaining green growth in the field. You're keeping your microbial activity throughout the season.
Mm-hmm.
It's giving things a crop to live off of. You're of course erosion sediment control
yep.
on the slopes that we farm, but it's also capturing nutrients that might not have been used by the crop completely, you know, in that growing season.
Right.
And
keeping
so,
it and from possibly leaching or eroding
right.
away, correct. You know, it's keeping in that top portion of soil profile for other things down the road, other crops that you might be rotating to be able to use.
Right, we're hoping to capture that in the following crop.
Mm-hmm.
In the spring, you know, when you come in at burn down, the one thing I love about it is when I'm spraying, I don't have a smorgasbord of species to worry about killing.
Right.
Because that rye, or, you know, your cover crop has shaded out those other species, and it's if it's a monoculture rye, that's easy.
Sure.
You know, you dive in it, you're killing one species.
Mm-hmm.
But it limits what you've got to spray to kill all those other species out
like,
there.
Like the henbit, the dead nettle, that always, like,
right.
These winter annual weeds that come up.
It's suppressing those.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you know, when you kill that cover crop and plant into it, it's also, if you have good enough growth, it's creating a shading effect to keep out regrowth, you know.
Sure.
After burn down. So it
in between when your crop actually begins to germinate and then canopy over.
Right.
Right.
It extends the window, I think, from pre planting burn down to post applications.
Sure. Sure.
That's the thing I like. And two, shading the ground, that keeps evapotranspiration
mm-hmm.
to a minimum. And especially in our climates, I mean, typically water is our limiting factor.
Now, yeah.
2018 was a totally different year.
Right. Spring and fall, right?
Right. Right. I mean, it 70-some inches versus 42 inches
yeah.
on average.
Incredible.
But in a typical year, which I don't know what one of those is anymore, but
right.
a typical year, that cover crop is going to help mulch to keep moisture retained.
Sure.
So it's kind of there's many benefits from it, I see. I mean, there are some challenges to it.
Mm-hmm.
There can be some side effects, and, you know, your seed-to-end ratio gets out of whack.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it can be tough. Rye can be a double-edged sword if you don't get on it in time and spray it.
It can – rye
spring
jumps.
Spring warms up.
Ooh,
oh, man.
Man, it can get tall very, very quickly, as you know.
Like I said, some of the best lessons are the ones learned the hard way, and I've had that happen.
Yeah.
But
So, and you kind of talked about it. You're obviously all based out of Virginia. And for me, moving from Virginia to the Midwest, there's been, I wouldn't say, I don't know if this is the right phrase, but a lag or a delay and innovative techniques coming across from east to west, in specifically farming. We're starting to see the use of cover crops quite a bit more, no-till drilling, but there's still quite a few operators, you know, disking things on a you know annual basis, pre-planting or post-harvest. But what are some of the things right now, Glenn, that you're seeing starting, you know, innovative on the East Coast that you might see come up in the next, you know, 5 years? Anything that's like, okay, this is cool, this is kind of new, here's some new science that's coming out, or again, like a new technique?
Yeah, the cover crop, that word has really taken off.
Mm-hmm.
In and out of the Bay. I mean, I'm
right.
using it in the Appomattox out of the Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And at home in the Bay. It's funny. Some people are just set in their ways, and I get
sure.
that. I mean, we all fight that in anything that we do.
Not to throw out any names, but like our dads.
Right. 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 We live it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it seems to be a longer adoption rate or
right.
to do some of those things. Same thing with tillage.
Sure.
Some guys, I mean, I know in the Midwest with those deep topsoils, they, I mean, we have to no-till.
Yeah.
I have to no-till, one, to get it all done. I'm not burning the fuel.
That's right.
Two, to conserve our most important.
The resource itself.
Asset, resource, the soil itself, right. And try to build, you know, topsoil, organic
right.
matter. I tell people I meet at different events and stuff. I mean, you think about it in Virginia. I mean, that's where the settlers first came
yeah.
and started working the ground. I mean, we're farming subsoils now because the topsoil is gone.
Well, it basically, it's red clay.
Right. I mean, it's a sublayer that's been farmed for, you know, hundreds of years where
mm-hmm.
you go out west, those soils have not been farmed
yeah.
as long. I mean, there are a lot of glacial till soils, so that's a whole nother dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And they... They could till it as long as they want to, and they're not going to lose
right. Their topsoil's feet thick.
Yeah,
and we're right. talking okay. You know, Virginia, there was inches, and now, but then through those tillage practices, since it's been farmed since the 1600s, you've lost it. And I know North right. Carolina's the same way. It's red clay country, and that's why there's so many inputs that typically have to go in annually to basically increase the fertility of it, so you still get the same crop and yields out of it. But that's why I think there's such that big push and innovation coming from the east, moving back into the plains, the areas with lots of topsoil. But I read a book or listened to a seminar one time. It was talking about people going back and looking at like ancient civilizations. And what they were doing was calculating like how long those civilizations lasted. And they were all, you know, farming civilizations. And then they calculated basically the amount of topsoil that would have been there. And then the degradation of that topsoil or the eroding away and how long it would have taken for that topsoil and those practices, the tillage practices to basically remove all the topsoil. So then they couldn't have grown crops. And it's funny because the exact estimation of how long it took for that topsoil to erode away and be gone based on their mismanagement of it was the exact timing of the length of that civilization, like 500 years in a lot of instances. Really? And like, I think it's the Mediterranean. It's like they farmed it until they couldn't farm it and live on it anymore. And that civilization died. And now it's like, you know, what you're dealing with, you're farming clay and trying to build organic matter and make that soil as healthy as possible. But a lot of places in the East Coast, because they've been tilling for so long or farmed for so long, you know, they're not, they've lost a lot of topsoil.
Yeah, it's, I'm showing my age and I can't remember, but I vividly remember the wow effect that there was a slide in college on how long it would take to lose an inch of topsoil. Mm-hmm. And in some tillage practices and elevations, I mean, that can happen in a year.
Yes.
And
yes.
How long it takes to rebuild an inch of topsoil. That was the astonishing number. I forget how long it was. It was a long time.
It's a long, long time.
That was eye opening.
Yeah.
But back to the practices that are moving and, mm-hmm. and coming that way. I mean, one neat story, and I know everybody knows his name, but David Hewler, he's corn growing champion, has world record corn yield, mm-hmm. and he's done it on a Virginia soil.
Wow.
He's done it on the James River, yep. a Pamunkey soil, an old soil. I mean, it's our state soil, but a very productive soil. But he's grown the highest corn yield ever recorded on an old Virginia soil. So, wow. I mean, that just shows what can be done. Granted, his family has farmed it for many, many years,
mm-hmm.
and he is a tremendous farmer and as humble as can be.
Right.
But, you know, it's... I hear guys say, you know, they have to manage the residue and this and that. That's why they till. And then I look at David growing 400 and some bushels of corn in a no-till operation.
Goodness
I'm
gracious.
Like, you know, it's all how you look at things.
Sure.
And that's, I'm not saying it fits for everybody because there are challenges in mm-hmm. no-till. There are challenges in till, challenges in cover crop, no cover crop. I mean,
sure.
But it's guys are starting to experiment now with more things and give mm-hmm. it a try. I mean, I think our world population in itself now is more open to change
right.
and try new things.
All right. So for a real estate story, I guess, you know, we do listings.
I don't know if everyone can hear this, but it's a pat on the back.
This is just an idea. I guess the importance of kind of the way you market your if you're a person getting ready to list your property, or you're kind of maybe you are a buyer, this is kind of just a quick story on kind of different things, ways you can do it. This is the way Matt and I market and try to do our blend our consulting with our real estate. So a couple weeks ago, I think it was a couple weeks ago, I can't remember.
February 6th is when the property got listed.
And people probably think we're so
available.
Stupid when it comes to it. Like, I don't remember when we do so many podcasts
yeah.
and we do so much consulting and so many reports, and all this different stuff that where really when it comes to the
Today's a Sunday. I know
I can't tell the difference between the only difference I know about the first few podcasts we ever did and now is the different mics we use. Yeah, outside of that, I don't remember much about them. And so we had a listing. Actually, we had a buyer over about a year ago.
It was March of last.
Looking for a property to purchase, hunt on, but invest in and possibly resell. And so our idea was let's buy a rough piece of ground. Let's transform it.
Let's buy it at the right price.
Buy it at the right price. You make your money on the purchase, not on the sell.
Rough piece of ground.
So rough piece of ground. It was logged.
Yep.
It was grown up. And I say that in air quotes because some people have different versions of grown up.
Sure. This was a healthy, great grown up.
It had been logged just a few years ago. Yeah. Actually, the listing agent, when we toured it, said there was deer everywhere. So, or I guess before we got there. So that's what caught our eye. He said it's very rough. It's been logged. It's very thick, but lots of deer. Bing, bing, bing. Okay, let's check it out.
Chicken dinner.
And ended up looking at it. And the buyer was like, what do you guys think? We said, man, this is pretty nice. There's already logging trails, skidder trails put in place. There's already loading docks that could be turned into food plots.
We can punch in a few others.
There is a good opportunity here with fire breaks. This is an area that's woodland landscape, native landscape.
It's accessible from all sides.
Yep. There's a power line on one side it had a good foundation. And so basically we went in there and bought it at the right price or the buyer bought it at the right price. We helped transform it, prescribe fire, food plots, and trail cameras.
Stand location.
They harvested some deer off it this fall and they decided they wanted something a little closer to home. They'd made their investment and they were ready to try and move to the next property. And so 9 months or 10 months after purchase, they listed it, or we listed it, and it was under contract.
It was listed, under contract, and closed in 16 days.
Perfect. There you go.
And they wanted something quick to be able to, you know, move on something else. They had some other things happen. They're like, you know what, let's try and see what we can do. But from an investment standpoint, check, that worked. From a hunting standpoint, they improved the habitat, and were able to turn around quickly. And that's where basically, you know, a plan from the very beginning of what you're going to do, how you're going to do it, is super important to develop. That's why we honestly do consulting, because we know the value of, okay, this is what needs to be done. Here's where you get the most bang for your buck out of these projects. Let's go in, let's do it. And then on the flip side, coming back in and showing that through a marketing standpoint. So again, February 6th, I believe this property officially was listed and available. In 16 days, it was closed in a pretty nice offer. So anyhow, just a great example of, okay, let's find the right piece. Let's purchase it. Let's make a plan. Let's make a game plan, execute it, and get it back out there. And there you go. 16 days later, it's sold and on to the next
land and legacy management plan and maps.
There you
transferring with the purchase. So the next landowner now has that available. So
anyhow, that's just the kind of the complete story with that property. But that's one, and we're looking for others to be able to do the same thing. So if you've got a property and you're looking to do similar things with it, contact us, let us know. Or if you want to be making those same types of moves financially from an investment standpoint, we would love to be able to help you out. Contact us at info@landlegacy.tv. We'll get with you and try and do the same thing for you guys.
There you go.
Done. He nailed it. I'm always encouraged to talk to farmers who are adopting new techniques and using technology to their advantage. And from aerial seeding, from the nutrient management plans, from with that Class C nutrient management plan. He is really taking that technology and doing precision agriculture, even from amending the soil to the planting rates. What blew my mind, I didn't know that he was doing to this degree, is but in each zone within a field, the planter is in sync in changing the population based on the zones, how many kernels of corn basically is being planted. So in areas that are a little more fertile, he's bumping up the number of kernels and basically minimizing the spacing between stalks, because that portion of the field is that much more productive than others. So he's getting more out of land, being extremely efficient with the technology, and it's awesome.
So it's
robotic.
It's not. It's. I guess it's. It goes without saying, he's not broadcasting seed. Or he's not using an no-till drill. That's
his
not
cover
a,
crop seed. He is.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, from an aerial standpoint. That's broadcasted. But
And that's not a burn on no-till drills. No-till drills are called controlled spills. So they don't count the actual seed that's going out. It's more of a kind of poundage per acre type thing.
Well, that and he kind of talked about the difference between.
Oh, did okay
a little bit. I think that was actually maybe pre-recording, but talking about he loves from a precision standpoint. To use his planter as much as possible, because it is it is counting seeds dropping per acre spacing a lot more than the drill. But this year, because he's strapped from, he's got 1,000 acres up here and 900 down here or whatever the ratio is, they're 3 hours apart, different growing seasons, moving and mobilizing the equipment, he's going to be basically be planting all the soybeans with a drill, so a little less precise than the planter, and he's going to be planting all the corn with his planter. So basically, to answer your question, he's adapting and altering things. So it's cool though, because with the times, you always have to just manipulate and roll the punches, and that's what he's doing.
That's right.
And trying to make the best sound practices available. And honest about, pros and cons from a planting situation, from a mending soil situation, to a cover cropping situation. All these things have their challenges, and you know what? He's open and forward about it. So I hope there's some interesting
I hope yeah, things out hopefully there. They get some brainstorm stuff going on with that. Maybe it opens up an idea for them on something they can do on their farm.
Mm-hmm.
Also, check out our Facebook page, Land and Legacy. I'm going to try and add these events that we talked about before we jumped into the interview. I'm going to add those to our events tab. Also, if you guys enjoy this podcast, please leave us a review or recommendation on Land and Legacy Facebook page. Check out our YouTube channel. We're going to start dropping some more videos soon. And then if you listen to us on iTunes, give us a review, please.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, guys, we appreciate you joining us for another podcast. We'll catch you next time.
We'll see you.